I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I say to you today, my friend, let freedom ring. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to AJC Radio, where we are bringing the message of justice around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, no matter what you're doing tonight, we're going to tell you to take a pause and get in your kitchen, get at the dining room table if dinner is just coming out the oven. It's getting ready to get cooking here at AJC Radio. I'm Lamont Banks, along with Sam Thurman, Charlisa Stewart, and Cliff Stewart, and I guarantee you, you're in for a treat tonight. How's everybody doing tonight?
Doing good. I'm hungry.
Okay.
Get the chicken.
Well, folks, this is, again, AJC Radio. We're coming live from Colorado Springs, Colorado. With folks, we're excited about what's getting ready to take place tonight on this program. And I'm telling you, Sam, Cliff, great things are happening. And we're excited here at AJC Radio. We want to chime in on that for us. Before we go there, Lisa, can you read our disclaimer, please?
Yes, we just want to remind everyone that we are not attorneys and that A Just Cause does not provide any legal advice. You want to contact your own personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of A Just Cause. And as always, we want to thank you for choosing to tune in and spend a little time with us this evening.
Well, America, there's a couple of things happening right now in our country. We're going to get straight to that. We have an exciting show tonight. And we're going to be talking about the unseen heroes of advocacy. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of heroes that you find in our society that have that they're not on the front page of the New York Times or the Denver Post, but I'm telling you, they are making an impact. And we consider them to be heroes of those that are trying to seek change and bring that change to this country. And as we talk about that tonight, we have three guests tonight. Our first guest is going to be Teresa Hodge, a very, very classy lady doing some great things, and I'm not going to give it away. It's like going down on Christmas Eve and kind of peeking in the Christmas box. We don't want to do that tonight. We're going to give you an opportunity to let her tell you what's going on. So we have her. We're going to have Howard Franklin. He's a ex-public defender, retired public defender, and also an author doing great things, was doing public defending at the Civil Rights Movement. And last but not least, definitely not least, Ramon Hamilton, a talented director of short films online, things that are compelling that will make you move. Sam, you had an opportunity to look at that. We don't want to get too deep into that either, but what are your thoughts on that?
Man, when I looked at Ramon's production of the whole series, man, that was it gives an eye-opening kind of a first-person account, if you will, or like a second-person account of what happens when somebody's in the hole. And if folks haven't looked at that, they need to go out there and look at it. But, yeah, you know, we'll jump in there with Ramon a little bit later on that.
Sure.
But like you say, some powerful, very powerful video.
Good stuff happening. Lisa, you look like you're full of information and excitement. What's on your mind?
I'm just ready to talk about this current news. That's where I'm looking at.
Well, let's go. Lisa, we'll let you kick it off. Let's go with the current news. What's happening in America right now?
All right. Let's see. This is dated Saturday, May 23rd. We're looking at an article that talks about protests and arrests following the acquittal of the Cleveland police officer. Now, this is the officer that shot those and killed the, well, they're saying he didn't actually kill them. They don't know who killed them. That's what they're claiming. He shot and he basically, in my opinion, shot and killed two people in a car who were unarmed. They heard a car backfire, and the police officers mistook that car backfire for gunshots.
Wow.
Now, I'm sorry, but if you're a police officer, should you not know the difference?
Well, absolutely.
Between a backfire and an actual gunshot.
There's a distinct difference.
You know a little something about gunshots, don't you?
A little bit. I've been in the fire to the shooting range a few times, but there's a distinct difference between the backfire of a car and somebody shooting a gun. It might sound, initially it might startle you that, that could have been a gunshot. But immediately you understand, especially a police officer will understand in a matter of 1 second that, that was not that was not gunfire. That was a car backfire. It's a total different sound.
Well, absolutely. And like you said there, we find it very easy that we're seeing in the news. Folks are trying to excuse, this was a mistake. Well, the human lives are involved here. Those mistakes are costly and can't happen. So you find that these folks tend to make excuses. You know what? You're trained better than that. I would believe or would like to think that if I'm watching a movie and it's a backfire of a car and then the gun part of the movie where people may be shooting or cops shooting, I kind of know the difference watching it on TV.
That's right. And I mean, this is no mistake by this cop. I mean, this cop jumped up onto the hood of the car and fired 15 shots through the windshield. But they say, well, we can't determine that it was his bullet. Sure, he shot him 15 times, but we can't determine if his bullets are the one that killed him. Now,
wow.
The common sense says, hey, we should take issue with that. The other piece of that, if it's me or you, let's just take me for an example. I go down, me, three friends. We go shoot up somebody's car, and I shoot 15 shots through the windshield. Now, if people die, they say, okay, well, we can't determine if it was your bullets that killed the person, but the fact that you were there, you're an accomplice to a murder. Mm-hmm. Guess what charge you get? You get the same exact murder charge as if someone went up to the car and pulled the trigger point blank and shot them in their head. Mm-hmm. Even if you didn't have a weapon, if you were there, you were a part of the crime, you're an accomplice, guess what charge they're going to get you for? Murder one.
Well, Cliff, a good example, Waco, Texas.
Yeah.
The motorcycle gangs. They hauled off 100 and some, motorcycle gang members. Every single one of them is charged with murder.
Yes.
That's right.
Every one of them. Now, when it comes to cops, and that's what the people of Cleveland are saying, is that if this were me and you, it would be totally different. This is another example of why the community is saying, hey, police, when it comes to police officers, there's no charge, there's no, nothing happens. Even if they get a charge, then how do you get acquitted on a murder charge when it says, yes, you might have pulled the trigger, we found your bullets in the person's body, but we cannot determine if those bullets are the one that killed them? That makes absolutely no sense.
No sense.
What about at least attempted murder?
Well, like we were talking before the show, I mean, forensics analysis, ballistics tests have come a long, long way. So, how they can say that they can't tell that the bullets came from your weapon, that's a cover-up.
So, if I'm hearing correctly, this gentleman was not charged with any crime?
He was charged.
He
was acquitted.
He was acquitted.
Basically saying, you didn't commit any crime, even though
jury or judge.
This was by Judge O'Donnell in
Cleveland.
He had a bench trial.
Pretty much, he had a what do you call it?
A preliminary.
he had a bench trial, but I would call it a front trial, where they basically saying, we're just going to bring you so that the people don't riot too much. We're just going to pretend like we're giving you a trial, but you're going to get off on this. 15 shots while you're standing on the hood of the car with people with no – they don't even have weapons. What weapon did you see, officer?
You've got 137 rounds fired at these people. Between, they said, were about a dozen officers that fired a total of 137 rounds at the car. Then you've got this man jumping on the hood like a maniac, firing 15 shots through the windshield at people who have been shot up already.
Well, we made the statement when this story came up initially that he apparently had a flashback to Iraq.
Right, exactly.
Perhaps he thought Saddam Hussein was in the car. Something terribly went wrong, apparently. But newsflash, Saddam is dead. He died some while ago. Somebody needs to get that man some help because something is terribly lacking.
I mean, at least they could have said, you know, he went crazy, something. But listen to what the judge says. In explaining his verdict, Judge O'Donnell said it was reasonable for Brelo, this is the man standing on the hood, fired 15 times through the windshield. It's reasonable for Brelo to think Russell and Williams still posed a threat to officers. Now, the fact that they even use these words to say still posed a threat, they never posed a threat at all in the first place. This was a car backfiring. So now they're spinning what happened in the situation. So they say Brelo thought that they still posed a threat to officers. The chase started after a car driven by Russell backfired. Noise officers mistakenly thought was caused by gunshot. The judge also said he couldn't be sure Brelo fired the fatal round. But then listen to what Brelo's attorney said, this fool named Patrick D'Angelo. He said authorities went too far in charging his client at all. The prosecution in this case spared no expense and was, in fact, ruthless, he said. We fought tooth and nail, as you saw in the courtroom. It was classically a case of David versus Goliath. What are you talking about? You killed your client killed two unarmed people, and you say that the prosecution was ruthless. He fired 15 rounds through the windshield as he's standing on the hood of the car. Where did he see the threat?
Well, again, in his mind.
Yeah, in his mind, he was in Iraq. He was in the middle of the desert, and he was getting sniper fire. So
yes,
and you know, another ironic twist on this is that, and I don't know if that report actually came out today, or what I'm getting ready to talk about is the Justice Department reached a settlement, or the city of Cleveland reached a settlement with the Justice Department, and where federal authorities have said that there is a pattern of unconstitutional policing and excessive use of force by the police department in Cleveland. Now, they just announced that in the media yesterday, that they expect that report to be coming out soon. So
yeah,
the fact that you have this guy get acquitted, and then right on the heels of that, the federal government is saying, you know, but you guys in Cleveland are doing something wrong, and you're violating people's constitutional rights. There is something wrong going on in Cleveland, and this is just more evidence of that.
No, absolutely. And, you know, folks better pay attention to that very, very clearly. I think it's clearly seen that, again, you have that report. And
it goes back to the culture. The culture of Cleveland police is that you guys overreach, you mistreat people, you kill them without cause, and then you get off by
the
judge.
And then the judge say, I got your back.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you are wondering what you're hearing tonight, maybe unconventional, not popular, something that's very seldom heard, and that is telling it like it is. The saying is, it is what it is. Ladies and gentlemen, AJC Radio is about telling it like it is, if you will. And I'm telling you, we're not going to shy away from this or any other controversy that may be going on. Ladies and gentlemen, the music tells us one thing. Dinner's wrapping up, possibly, or you're just sitting down with a nice meal. The forecast in New York City is 77 degrees. Folks may be walking downtown New York, Times Square, wherever you are, find a room, a booth, or head on home, because we got something great coming on AJC Radio. We want to be honored with Teresa Hodge, a classic woman making a difference. And I tell you, we got some good stuff to talk about. Get the kids set down, get the dog fed. We're coming right back. This is AJC Radio. Don't go nowhere. For a kid whose mom or dad is in prison, life is tough. Now add a wrongful conviction to that. Life just got a little bit tougher. Trying to explain to friends why mom or dad is not at the school play or at the ball game is something that no kid should ever be faced with. Especially if mom or dad is innocent. Ladies and gentlemen, get involved today to stop the epidemic of wrongful convictions. By remembering a just cause with a monthly, annual, or one-time donation, you can help in the fight against wrongful convictions. Call a just cause today. 1-855-529-4252. We seek justice for the children. As they go to bed at night and mom's not there, dad's not in the other room to make them feel safe. Not because dad or mom did anything wrong, because justice could not be found. Join us for the children, for they truly are our future.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect, but together we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to innocenceproject.org to make a donation and get involved.
We have a big problem, and we need your help.
It's happening on college campuses, at bars, at parties, even in high schools.
It's happening to our sisters and our daughters.
Our wives and our friends.
It's called sexual assault, and it has to stop.
We have to stop it. So listen up.
If she doesn't consent, or if she can't consent, it's rape, it's assault.
It's a crime. It's wrong.
If I saw it happening, I was taught you have to do something about it.
If I saw it happening, I speak up.
If I saw it happening, I'd never blame her. I'd help her.
Because I don't want to be a part of the problem.
I want to be a part of the solution.
We need all of you to be part of the solution. This is about respect. It's about responsibility.
It's up to all of us to put an end to sexual assault. And that starts with you.
Because one is too many.
Ladies and gentlemen of America, that's the sound of Dallas, and we bring that song on tonight as we bring in the Honorable Teresa Hodge, a lady making a difference. And you're wondering, why are we playing Dallas? Well, I got the privilege of talking to Teresa this week, and she happens to be a Dallas Cowboy fan, and that makes two of us, and I thought we'd take a couple of minutes and say hello as a Dallas Cowboy fan. And Teresa, we welcome you tonight. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you. I am doing well, and I appreciate the Dallas Cowboy introduction.
Isn't that something else? That's how Dallas Cowboys get it done, isn't it?
So absolutely.
We are very, very happy to have you tonight. And I tell you, this team and all of the AJC team welcome you, and we are excited about the conversation getting ready to take place tonight. And we're excited. And Teresa, I'll give them a brief situation. We understand you have about 20 minutes.
I am fine. I am stationary, and so I'm able to talk as long as we need to talk, but I also know that you have some other very important guests that you will have on as well.
Okay, so we're going to just cut through the chase. And Teresa, it says here, Teresa, and I'm just going to give you a little intro as we see it here on the profile here. a passionate advocate for people with criminal connections. She is committed to reducing the lasting harm that is caused by prison. I told the folks earlier, Teresa, that it's kind of like Christmas Eve. I didn't want to give too much information away. You can't peek at the gifts the day before Christmas. Well, we consider you a gift on this program. So we're going to let you go ahead and take the floor and introduce yourself and tell the folks what you're doing out there and the difference that you're making.
Okay, well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with AJC Radio and all the listeners. I am based in Washington, D.C., and the name of the organization that I founded with my daughter, Lauren, is Mission Launch. And we are very passionate around helping the more than 700,000 people who come home from prison every year get back on their feet. In D.C., we've started a coalition of service providers. We call it Rebuilding Reentry because we're really focused on helping these individuals get back on their feet. What the deal is that a person has about 65 days from the time they come home to prison to latch to some type of community, whether it's a faith community, a program, a job, something. And if not, then the likelihood that they will go back to prison increases only after 65 days. So we have just a very short window to make a difference in the lives of people, and that's what we're trying to do.
Oh, absolutely. And that's amazing. I never looked at it that there is a window of opportunity to get these folks where they don't return back to prison. Teresa, what gave you this passion that sparked you, if you will, to do such a thing and to have such a commitment for something so very important?
Well, for me, it was a personal experience. In March of 2001, a legal nightmare for me began. This legal nightmare turned my life upside down and, quite frankly, inside out. It's been a 14-year battle. And that was a legal case that I personally had. I was an entrepreneur, a business owner, and I was doing business in the state of Maryland. And one of my employees, who we had decided to let go, decided that he wanted to be vindictive, and he wrote the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission and said that he thought that my business partner and I and our organization were going to take advantage of people. We were selling a financial literacy product. We were selling it mostly to the African-American community, many of which were in the faith-based community. So what started off as something, just a person being vindictive, created a tailspin for my life. Once the government got a hold of the case, it just continued to escalate and escalate and escalate. The Federal Securities and Exchange Commission decided that there was no case, and they didn't want to be bothered with it. So they sent it down to Maryland Securities Office. Maryland got a hold of it and wouldn't let it go. They did what's called a summary judgment order, and what that really means is they feel like they have a hands-down case, and they rush you into court to get a judgment. Well, they lost their judgment against us. We won our state case, and quite frankly, they were angry because the government, when it comes to legal battles, don't like to lose. And so they repackaged the case. They called it mail fraud, sent it back to the federal government, and from there I was convicted of mail fraud and some other trumped-up charges. I was naive. I went to trial, believing justice would prevail. I was, prior to that, I was a military brat. My father had served 21 years in the Air Force. I had married a man who was in the Air Force. I had worked for 10 more years for the federal government, had been an entrepreneur. So I felt like going to court, justice would prevail. At best, there might be an administrative violation. And if we had violated something administratively, not knowingly, that sure, somehow it would just be identified and we would be able to move on. But instead, I was convicted. I served 87 months. I received an 87-month federal prison sentence. I ended up serving 70 months because I was able to win part of an appeal. So this is not, I'm not doing reentry because it's something good to do. I'm doing it because I've lived the reentry experience and I've lived what it's like to go through the federal prison system.
Okay, so, you know, as you and I had an opportunity to share some of those moments, you know, I say on this program, Teresa, every week, that Lady Justice MIA, and that she is missing in action. And I presume you have the same sentiment based upon what happened to you in that case.
Absolutely. I discovered after I was sentenced that about 96% of the people who are convicted by the government actually go to prison. And they go to prison because most of them take plea agreements. But at the end of the day, the government has about a 96% conversion, a success ratio, from the people that they indict, rather.
That's unbelievable, because you recognize, based upon the numbers and the studies about the wrongful convictions that take place in this country, that the math doesn't add up, does it? That if you got a 96% conversion conviction rate in this country, then why do the numbers go against that for the folks that have been wrongfully convicted? The math doesn't add up. I was taught in first grade or second grade going to the chalkboard and putting number one plus one. Well, believing as a little tyke with my little Nikes on or whatever, I was wearing blue jeans or corduroys at that time, that one plus one is two. Didn't that add up in the justice system, does it, Teresa?
No, it doesn't. And even more alarming is when you really think of the statistics where America has 5% of the world's population, but yet we have 25% of the world's prisoners. So what we're dealing with is an out-of-control judicial system.
Well, absolutely. Lisa, I think she had a comment for you, Teresa.
Hi, Teresa. This is Lisa Stewart. How you doing?
I'm great, Lisa. How are you?
Pretty good. I had a question for you. I was looking at your website, your Mission Launch website, and you're talking about how people, after being released, you said after a year after release, up to 60% of formerly incarcerated people are not employed. And without any help, then one in four of those Americans will continue to be locked out of employment opportunities. What are you doing to try to help helping these people after leaving prison find employment?
Well, actually, I want to just correct one thing. There's one in four Americans today, roughly 70 million people, who are required to check the box whether they've been convicted or have some type of criminal arrest. So that's one in four Americans have had some type of altercation with the judicial system. What we're doing is we are working to create technology by way we provide services directly to service providers. And we are working with the service providers to help them become more efficient by creating technology that would allow them to do their job a little bit better. In addition to that, we work with returning citizens, and that's what we call them here in Washington, D.C. We work with individuals who are coming home from prison, and we help them to learn how to use technology as well to get back on their feet. Because for most of us, when you're in prison, you're locked out of all of the massive changes that are taking place, too.
Right.
So we believe that through technology, we're working with local corporations, the Office of Human Rights here in D.C., just to make sure that individuals, when they come home from prison, they have a fair chance, a fair shot at employment.
And is that working well there in D.C.?
It's starting to work. It takes a lot of education. It takes civic engagement. We've got to really reframe the conversation. As long as we're allowed to think of a person who's been to prison as an ex-convict, an ex-felon, an ex-something that's derogatory, we're labeling them and we're placing them in a situation where for the rest of their lives they're just going to continue to be stigmatized. You know, for me, I call it the invisible life sentence. You get out of prison, but really it's not over, because as long as you have to check boxes and notify people up front that you've been to prison, then you are putting yourself at a significant disadvantage.
Absolutely.
Teresa, this is Sam Thurman. How you doing?
I'm good, Sam.
Thanks for joining us on the program. Quick question for you. As far as the criminal trial that you had, it was a jury trial, is that correct?
Yes, it was.
So was the jury denied the information as to all the, like you explained, the high-level twists and turns in this case as far as, you know, The Federal Securities and Exchange didn't want it, and so it got bumped down to the state level, and then it got bumped to another level, and then they put the catch-all mail and wire fraud thing on there. Was the jury allowed to hear all of that, the fact that there were grounds for no charges being brought because of the fact that, you know, at the highest level of the Securities and Exchange, they didn't even want to entertain it?
Right. The jury was bombarded with so much information. My case, when you start talking about a securities case, it becomes very complicated, and the average person is unable to process all of that information. The first thing that I learned was that you don't really get a jury of your peers, because people who were business people and who could have understood my case weren't allowed. They were disqualified for some reason or another to participate. So I had a jury, but it wasn't a jury of people who, in my opinion, were qualified to really hear and understand the case. And then you have the prosecutors who are going back and forth trying to deny certain information to be heard and presented to the jury. So it's actually just an extremely complicated process, and quite frankly, unless you live it, you really don't understand it, and you don't get just how the cards are really stacked against you.
Well, you know what? I don't mean to sound like a broken record. Ladies and gentlemen of America, what you're hearing tonight from Teresa sounds very similar as the twin sister of the IRP fit.
It's right out of the same place.
So that's amazing, because the same things, Teresa, that you dealt with, and I think we had a good opportunity to speak about the IRP 6 case. As you had an opportunity to look a little bit over what's happened to these six guys, comparing to your story, how similar does it seem to you?
Well, I think it's similar, and the what's really sad is it's not uncommon. What has happened to them, what happened to me, what happened when I went to prison, I recognized I wasn't alone. There were a lot of people who were in prison for trumped-up charges, and it is just difficult to get justice when you go into a courtroom.
And that goes against, Teresa, everything, as I shared with you. My mother raised us that if you do the right thing, you don't break the law, you do the things, if something happens, guess what? Our police officers, our judicial system, will prevail for you. I felt the same way, as we've had an opportunity to share with my wrongful conviction. I thought, well, there's no way I'm being convicted because I didn't do it.
Right.
I said a couple of weeks ago on this program that the presumption of innocence, that was a bus that left town quite some time ago. It's not here anymore. So folks are standing at the bus stop wondering, where's the bus? It's not coming. Excuse the English, but it ain't coming. It's not going to come. But I think with what you're doing, Teresa, it sounds so intriguing to me that you're willing to get down in the trenches and help these people. But I think because of what you've been through and seeing it firsthand, I would think that's what has fueled your passion. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. It is what fuels my passion. People often ask, you know, what motivates you to do what you do? Quite frankly, going to prison motivated me to do what I do today. Having someone believe that they could destroy my life and all that I had built up to a certain point, it motivates me to do what I do. And furthermore, I feel like if other people had done it beforehand, perhaps it would not have been allowed to happen to me. But when people go to prison, they become voiceless, and they are beaten down, and they're broken by the system. And it is so much easier to come home and try to rebuild your life. But instead, I decided to turn lemon into lemonade, and I just decided that this was not going to continue to happen, and I was just going to be the voice for the voiceless.
And I think it couldn't be said better than that, Teresa. I think that is absolutely admirable. That is something that, to me, because you've basically gone against the odds, because the system is set up that once you go to prison, in the end, I think the point that you said, was it invisible?
Invisible life sentence is what I call it, that you go to prison, you serve your debt, and when you come home, there are other things that are working that, to the naked eye, it's invisible. But for those 700,000 people who come home from prison every year, it's everything but invisible.
Well, absolutely right. Go ahead, Coach.
Yeah, I was going to say, Teresa, and we're glad to have you on the show tonight. When I'm listening to your story, and I'm thinking of the parallel to the IRP6 case. I mean, first you have the overreach by the Federal Reserve. They come in, and in your situation, it's I'm trying to figure out how is it not a double jeopardy? How do they say, okay, there's basically nothing that we find here, but then they come back and they get you on this mail and wire fraud, which is just something they throw up against the wall and see what sticks. Same thing happened in the IRP6 case where the FBI came back and said, there's no case here. This is a civil matter. You know, it was a case of a company that owes staffing companies money. Then you have the government come back and say, okay, well, we'll go for mail fraud and wire fraud. We'll see what happens. They didn't give the jury all of the evidence. And the statement that you made about the jury of your peers not being that's not what happens. I mean, it was so prevalent in the IRP6 case because, like you said, you have business people that could have come in and said, I understand what you're doing from a business perspective. How is it that you guys are looking at this person committed any crime? But you look at this overreach, you look at how just anything they charge you with, when you get indicted, there's a 96% chance that you're going to prison. Not just getting convicted, but going to prison. And I think that is what makes the American justice system so flawed, because you can't have a system. I said on the show before, the only thing that has that type of success rate is the sunrise. That, 96% of the time, the sun's going to rise up. That other percent is when you have a solar eclipse every 7 years. It does not make sense. And
it doesn't make sense.
But to understand that you've basically seen that, with the invisible life sentence, that you can come out and say, I have to advocate, I have to fight for others who have gone through the same thing, that are basically, in the same jaws of this justice system that is broken and, quite frankly, completely corrupt.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have to stand up and speak for those of us who've been through the process to prevent others from going through the process as well. And so there's been an 813% increase in the number of women who've gone to prison. And you have to ask yourself why. We've all, have read everything that says the war on drugs has not worked, but yet we've just continued to put more and more people in prison. So the system of prison is working very well. And it's one of those things where we have turned our back, the general public, and we are allowing the government to handle this business. And many people are allowed to believe that if the government indicts you or if someone goes to prison, they're guilty. And right now what we have to do is kind of reframe that conversation. We've got to let the American public know that this is happening at an alarming rate. And if we're not careful, it's going to happen either to you or to someone you know.
Well, what we find with that, Teresa, is that until that happens, I think you made a good point. When you went through the process, that changed you for life. The title of this program tonight is Those Unseen Heroes of Advocacy. You fit the mold to that. As other people do, but I think people need to be very much made aware of, there was a price tag involved with that. There was a price tag that brings your passion to the level that it is, and that price tag is about what you suffered, what you went through. As we had a great conversation this week about those times and those moments, they do fuel you, and they fuel you for life. So we consider you a hero out there doing what you're doing. Like you said, had somebody spoke up before, perhaps you didn't have to walk that road, because when you speak up, and as I said on this program, we're gonna ask the tough questions, and we're gonna give the answers that may not be popular, but they do generate change, and that's what AJC Radio is about. And I think what you're doing is absolutely amazing, and should be commended for folks to. I mean, again, you've gone against all odds. The thing is that when you when you get out of prison, you basically you're doomed to fail because every door is closed, every chain around you that could be on you is locked on you, and you beaten the odds and say, you know what, I'm not going to let that dictate my life. I think that's commendable, and I'm telling you, Teresa, we need more people. We need more Teresa Hodges folks in our country right now that will set out to make a difference, along with other advocacy folks that are trying to make a difference. What I'd like to do, go ahead, Teresa, you can go to respond to that.
Well, I was going to say, I am fortunate to be a part of an organization. In addition to the work that I do with my daughter, Lauren, I am a part of an organization, Just Leadership USA, and what they are doing, they're raising up the voice of more advocates. So I am among amongst good company when it comes to heroes out there who are working. Right now, many of us are working in silo, and it's important, and that's why the work of AJC Radio is important, is to be able to amplify all of those voices, all of those stories, so that the world can see what's really happening.
Well, Teresa, I can tell you what you're hearing in the background is that which is attached to being an Avenger. The Avenger sounds right. And, if any folks know what Avenger means, the Avengers are fighting evil and they're fighting injustice. I don't know if you folks are old enough to remember a show called The Super Friends. When I was a youngster, you had Superman, Aquaman, and every other superhero.
Wonder Woman
and all of them. And Teresa, this is the kind of battle we're in, and I consider you a true Avenger. We want to definitely have you back on this program. If you're willing to come back with us, we want to have you back. There's something about highlighting heroes that makes a difference in society. Do us a favor, Teresa. Let the folks know out there how they can get a hold of you if they want to reach you. And we're going to let you off so you can make that nice drive home in there in Washington, D.C.
Well, I appreciate it. Our organization is Mission Launch. We can be found at mission-launch.org and then also rebuildingreentry.com. Both of those, we're on Facebook, Twitter as well. I'm on Twitter at Teresa Y. Hodge on Twitter. So I look forward to being able to come back on your show, definitely, and participate however I can and amplify the good work that you guys are doing.
And we appreciate that. And folks, if you think Twitter is not a good door to find great people, well, me and Teresa connected on Twitter, finding out how do you find a hero on Twitter? Well, it happened great privilege, Teresa. Have a safe drive home there in our nation's capital. And we're going to be talking to you here in a couple of weeks and making a trip up to your next destination. And we're going to sit down and break a little bread and have a little conversation, me and my beautiful sister, Charlisa. How's that sound to you?
It sounds wonderful. I look forward to it. Thank you, Lisa, Cliff, Sam, and Lamont. It has been a pleasure speaking with you this evening.
Okay, you take care. Have a great evening. We'll be in touch soon, Teresa.
All right. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are Avengers against the fight of injustice. And our issue is we need to make a change and make it now. We're going to take a quick break, come right back. And we are having the author, Howard Franklin. Hang on the line for us. We're looking forward to you. We got folks. We're being bombarded by superheroes tonight in the fight against injustice, in the search for justice. And we have Howard Franklin coming by, stand by with us. Folks, I know it's right now, I believe, on the East Coast, 9:15. You're probably, the wife's in the kitchen, maybe fixing a cup of coffee, maybe a Danish. maybe a Twinkie or a cupcake, whatever goes with coffee. We're going to come back. Folks, this is just getting started. This is AJC Radio, where we are highlighting Avengers of Justice and the heroes of advocacy. Come on back with us. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen of America, we find ourselves in a precarious situation as America, its citizens, stand at the crossroads of decision. Well, AJC Radio is committed. Coming June 4th, 2015, every Thursday evening, we will introduce a new campaign entitled Spotlight on Capitol Hill. The purpose of this campaign is to take each and every Thursday, we will spotlight a member of Congress and the initiatives that are important not only to them, but to their constituents and the nation and this country as a whole. Our purpose is to shine the light on congressmen, senators, men and women who are committed to the oath that they took when they were elected to public office. We find it very important that we would shine the light on something that is positive in a time of critical challenges that face this nation. So I invite you tonight to join us beginning June 4th, every Thursday, as we introduce Spotlight on Capitol Hill. As all Americans are trying to do, we are seeking justice. Join us for an exciting time of highlighting your congressman and your senator, that we might come together as a people and as a nation to bring about change. We look forward to you joining us June 4th and every Thursday thereafter. God bless you and God bless America.
Here are 50 white guys. Here are 50 black guys. Here's how many white guys can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. The chances amount to 1 out of 17. Now, here's how many black guys can expect the same thing. The chances are 1 out of 3. Why? Lots of reasons. It's complicated, but one thing is clear. There's a racial bias at every level of the criminal justice system. When blacks and whites commit the same kind of crimes, blacks are more likely to be arrested. Once arrested, they're more likely to be convicted. Once convicted, they're more likely to serve longer sentences. Look at the numbers in America's so-called war on drugs. About 14% of America's drug users are black, as are about a quarter of drug sellers. Yet blacks are 34% of people arrested for drug crimes. And those convicted of drug crimes, 46% are black. By the time we factor in sentencing, there are actually more black drug offenders than white ones in state prisons and federal prisons. In the end, the incarceration rate for drug crimes is 10 times higher for blacks than it is for whites. These are the facts. Racial disparities in America's war on drugs are one big reason that one of three black men can expect to go to prison in their lifetime.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are privileged tonight to shine the light on heroes of advocacy. As we have sat here tonight, right now in New York City, the sun is setting and folks have enjoyed a good day, but the sun is rising here at AJC Radio. And what do we mean by that? The sun of information, the rising of information, where AJC Radio is bringing the message of justice around the world. And that doesn't matter where you're at, folks, this evening as the twilight and the sun sets and folks are getting ready for bed, maybe puffing up the pillows to get comfortable, getting the remote control ready. But we're going to ask you to just pause. If you got a DVR, pause the live TV right now and tune in to us tonight as we talk about unseen heroes of advocacy. And with that, we have the privilege of a very talented young man, Arthur, a respectful gentleman who has been doing things since the Civil Rights Movement, and that is a Mr. Howard Franklin. Mr. Franklin, how are you tonight? And thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, be able to share with you and your audience.
Well, we appreciate that. May I call you Howard?
Oh, please do. And you know, I am speaking with?
This is Lamont. We have the privilege of talking.
Okay, Lamont. That's great. We have spoken once before.
Yes, we have. And, you know, I told the folks on the last segment with the all-star lineup of heroes tonight, it's kind of Christmas Eve. We can't peek in the package and give away to our audience the good gift that may be inside. We believe you have some information that we consider a gift to our audience and to those listening. We thank you for taking a few moments of your time this evening. I'm going to just let you have the floor, Mr. Franklin, introduce yourself and talk a little about what you've done and what your aspirations and where you're going. Our audience is very interested in hearing that.
Well, I appreciate that. I was in, you referred to the Civil Rights Movement, the original one, because we have a new one going on, and Lord knows we need it. I was a deputy public defender in Los Angeles County. I was stationed in the Compton Judicial District, which at that time, 1968, we're talking to 70, 71, I was in that location, incorporated the city of Compton and Linwood and our neighboring Watts and the unincorporated area of Willowbrook, which was at that time, probably still is, the heroin capital of the United States. And I served in that capacity, and we followed, that's only 5 years after the decision in Gideon v. Wainwright that made the wonderful ruling by the United States Supreme Court, the Warren Court, that you're going to get counsel if you're charged with a crime. And those people that came to fill the expanded public defender's offices where they already had them, they became larger. And in areas where they didn't have them, they opened them. And who came to fill those slots? Well, we were pretty young. I was 28 at that time. And they were men and women. They were idealistic. I think I mentioned to you before, I was in law school during the time of the Freedom Rides and the march, say, in Selma. So we, the five of us that were stationed in Compton, we viewed our role as an opportunity to participate in the civil rights movement by making changes within the system, which were badly needed. And we fought a war in Compton for about 2 years. And that's the subject of my novel, Gideon's Children, because I said, because of the Gideon decision, those of us that followed into those positions that the court made possible were children of Gideon. And that's the name of my novel. And I wrote the novel, and it became even more relevant while I was writing it. But I was looking 2, 3, 4 years ago and saying, geez, we've still got a tremendous amount of problems in our criminal justice system, all phases, from the police to getting into the courtroom. So you have public defenders, you've got prosecutors, you've got probation officers afterwards, you've got the prisons, police initially, of course, they're making arrests. Almost everywhere I looked, there were problems. So I said, how do you get knowledge out to the average person? Because we're a country of, I don't know, probably 320, 330 million people. And yes, there's television and movies, and people have a general idea of what goes on in the courtroom, but not really. They don't understand the whole process. And I say, how do you do that? And there's a tremendous number of books out on it. Most of them are nonfiction books, and they're excellent, but they tend to be a little drier. So I thought, how about we do a novel, which is a story with characters that are walking around. They're flesh and blood people. They laugh, they cry, they get nervous, They win, they lose, all the things that most people can relate to. And let's have a drama, because I participated in one, so we can take that and put it down there. And entertain people, because if you can entertain people, you can capture their attention, hopefully hold it, and in the process, give them an education as to how the system works and why it is important that we make it work the way it was designed. Because there's nothing really wrong with the way our criminal justice system is designed. It's based on a presumption of innocence until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem is, from part one, the police, all the way to the end, prison, and then maybe probation, and then trying to get back into society after that, it's run by people. Real live people, and we have some very, very good people, and then we have some people that aren't so good, and even the best make mistakes. So there's and because of the size of our society and the fact that we've, you know, the so-called, I know I was listening, the so-called war on drugs, which is one of the greatest failures in the history of the world. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, and Michelle Alexander did a wonderful job on that in her book, The New Jim Crow, because really, from a certain perspective, what was intended by the war on drugs was not to stop drugs. It was to have an excuse to continue to repress people of color, because we made some successes in the 60s. Things did get somewhat better. We have a Civil Rights Act of 1964. We've got a Voting Rights Act of 1965. Before that, we desegregated the schools in 1954. So some progress was made. It was looking good. The Ku Klux Klan sat around and said, oh, God, we're sort of out of business here. Now what do we do? Well, we could dream up, and it's not just them. There's a whole white power structure in our country, and I am a Caucasian, in case anybody listening wonders. It is a white power structure that said, how do we continue to do what we've been doing and hold the people of colors? That's black. It's also Hispanic today, because we have a large Hispanic. And there are other minority groups, too, Orientals, etc. How do we keep these people in their place? Well, how do we control things? Put them in jail. We can arrest for a half a marijuana cigarette. I once represented a client in Compton who did 5 years in San Quentin for possession of not quite a full joint. And that goes back. He was in the 50s when they really dealt out sentences for drugs. But that was the idea of it. So because of that, you have so clogged up the court system with drug cases that you almost can't get to the really serious crime, because there are some bad actors out there. There are people that think they can shoot people or rob them at gunpoint, rape. I mean, there's assault with a deadly weapon. There are some serious things that need to be dealt with. Our courts are almost overwhelmed. In certain places, they are. And if you look at the court calendar, the reason for that is all these drug cases, and most of them are minor drug cases. They were an excuse to put people away, and that's why we have the largest of any industrial country in the world. Our incarceration rate dwarfs anybody else's, and that's the historical reason for it. So what I wanted to do in Gideon's Children was illustrate the whole process, which by going through the adventure that's in the book, you learn the whole process, and then point out the value of our individual constitutional rights, which are protected by defense counsel. and most of them are public defenders, because, I mean, a lot of wealthy people, they might be committing white-collar crime, but they're not getting busted for what my people were getting busted for in Compton, Watts, and Willowbrook.
Right.
And what goes on in the ghetto today. Those individual constitutional rights, I'm talking about the Fourth Amendment, the right not to be illegally searched, Fifth, absolute due process and the right not to incriminate yourself, Sixth, right to counsel. They're very, very precious. And out of 300 million people, I look at myself, for example, outside of a couple of traffic tickets that I've gotten in my life, I didn't commit any crimes. So if I weren't a lawyer, if I hadn't have been a public defender, I might not know about our system, and I might not appreciate those rights because, hey, I don't commit crimes, so I don't have to worry about it. But yes, you do, because at any moment in time, you can be arrested for something. I can't recall. You referred to me as a young man, and I had a big smile on my face because I'm approaching my 75th day here in July. But
wow.
I can't remember any time when our basic fundamental rights were in such jeopardy.
Absolutely. And Mr. Franklin,
I mean,
if I could interject a question right there. This
sure.
is Sam. And again, you welcome for joining the program, and we are just in awe with your with the vast knowledge that you have and the background that you have and the history that you bring to the program. And
you
made mention of the constitutional rights, and as I was reading the press release on your book, Gideon's Children, and basically just reiterating something you just said, and in that release it says that the power of the state is enormous and that the only true protection against governmental abuse of power is the individual's supremely valuable constitutional rights. Now,
that
the
is
question,
so correct, and I don't think the vast majority of our fellow citizens of whatever color understand just how important those rights are. And it's the public defenders, in large part, that are going to defend those rights. Those were my weapons. That's what I had to work with. And sometimes facts. Sometimes I had witnesses that could say, hey, whatever the police officer said, that wasn't true, or whatever another civilian witness said, I had a witness that could counter that. But mostly, I had those rights, and without them, Sam, we are in such big trouble. Look at the Patriot Act, which at the moment is in abeyance, okay? But we've had, in this day of technology, we've got spying going on at all levels of government, and nobody's watching it. I mean, it's out of control.
And
try the no-fly rule,
for
example.
And then you compound that. And then you compound that with the blanket immunity and the Brady violations, and so.
Oh, absolutely.
What would you say to that? As far as it seems like that's just treading upon our constitutional rights.
No question. I appreciate fully that we need to be very cognizant of terrorists. They're out there. There are a lot of people in the world. That terror is a way of life for them. And we have 9/11. We've had other incidents. We've got a lot of trouble going on right now with ISIS, God knows. And the only problem is if in order to protect ourselves, we give up our own rights, then they won. I mean, but people don't understand that. When they get frightened, they say, oh, well, I'm never going to do anything wrong, so I don't care if the police are spying on me, if the CIA is listening to my conversation, if they're listening to our conversation right now, which if they want to, they are, and then the FBI is involved, and then the NSA. It's critical that we wake up in a hurry and realize that that's serious. And some people have, because as I sit here tonight and this morning's paper said, the Patriot Act is lapsing. They're desperately, the House had a bill, but the Senate couldn't get together with it because you've got a very divided Senate, and in this case, not just Democrats and Republicans. You had factions within each side of the aisle that couldn't agree. So they're trying to work out something that allows the proper way of collecting information so that we can be protected, but without having losing our complete right of privacy totally. And that's a problem. And only defense counsel is going to challenge that. Now, in a broader way, you can have the ACLU or the NAACP go in and challenge it, but they're acting as defense counsel. They're saying you can't use these weapons against regular people who haven't done anything. And you're starting with a presumption of innocence, which is the way our system works. And most people are. I'm not planning any terrorist acts, and I know you aren't. And yet, if they want to listen to us right now, they're listening. And if they don't like what I have to say about the Patriot Act, maybe they put my name in a file. I know that when I was a public defender, they were, you know, several police agencies kept files on me and the four gentlemen that I worked with between 1968 and 71. Nothing ever happened because of those files, but they were keeping files on us. And I don't know where they were turning that information over to the FBI or not. They might have, but we were considered dangerous and radical because we challenged the police in court. We weren't afraid to say, you're a liar, because sometimes it has to be said, and I was raised to believe. I don't want to create the impression either that police per se are bad. They're not.
Right.
We need police. If men were angels, the old saying goes, you wouldn't need government at all. We have to have police. There are some just bad actors out there. The problem as I see it, and I had in my days in Compton, I used to discuss this with police officers. I had several that I considered I was friendly with on the Compton Police Force, not so with Firestone Sheriff's Division, but with the Compton Police Department. We need very careful selection process when they accept somebody to go to the police academy. They have to vet that person and see what kind, and that includes psychological testing too. The type of person that wants to become a police officer likes a uniform, likes a badge, likes a gun. Okay, that's okay. All right, they're more of a military personality. They're comfortable with that. But you got to make sure that they have some degree of education as much as possible. And even more importantly, when you get high-quality people, and that's what we've got to get in our police departments, they've got to be trained and trained continuously. As a lawyer, as long as you're practicing and on your bar card it says active, you have to keep taking classes. They're called continuing education of the bar classes. Accountants have to do that. Doctors have to do that. Well, so should police officers. Because it is a very difficult job. I have ridden in police vehicles at night while they were on patrol. That was, we agreed that was a good experience, so I'd know what it was like that they were going through. And it's a very dangerous job.
Well, absolutely. Sir Franklin,
and it's scary. They've got to be trained to know how to diffuse and how to deal with mental illness, because we have a lot of that too.
Well, Mr. Franklin,
and then we would have, if we could get that, we'd have a much better chance of not having Ferguson and Cleveland and Detroit and all of, and North Charleston. I mean, that guy in North Charleston, boy, had he been properly vetted, they would never have hired him. And the records show that. There's an excuse what he did, but he should not have been in uniform, that particular officer.
Mr. Franklin, I'll tell you this. The danger of what you're talking about is definitely on the rise. And I'll tell you this, as we are listening to your points, I'll tell America to take note tonight. Mr. Franklin, the difference here
when you have a group of superheroes as we have on this program tonight, we don't have enough time to get to everything. But I tell you what, your information is definitely informative. We're going to have to invite you back to continue your knowledge that I guarantee has been very informative for our folks tonight as we have to change gears here. Mr. Franklin, can you tell the folks how do they get a hold of you and how can they reach you to hear more about this intriguing conversation tonight?
All they have to do is if they have a computer, and most people do of some sort, or a tablet or whatever, anything that will hook up to the Internet, take my whole name, Howard G. You have to put the G in the middle, howardgfranklin.com, and that'll take you to my author's website, and that allows people to send me emails, and I answer everyone I ever get. Not always the same day, but I get there. And so howardgfranklin.com, and I'd be delighted to hear from everybody, and I would be more than pleased to come back and share with you anytime you have time.
Okay, Mr. Franklin, thank you so much. And that is, and you said earlier about your age, 75 years old, we'll say 75 years young, and thank you for joining us tonight. We appreciate you joining us.
Do you hear that sound?
Sounds like a popping of what, Lisa?
Sounds like Red Bull to me. If you guys are like me and need a Red Bull to keep you going for the rest of the night, go ahead, crack one open, take a couple sips, and come back with us on the other side. We'll be right back.
And ladies and gentlemen, what that means is Lisa's a Red Bull expert.
Addict.
She's in Red Bull
but I tell you what,
rehab.
But I tell you what, folks, if you've had a long day, Lisa, Red Bull should put you on their payroll tonight, because if you need a lift up, Red Bull. But guess what? I guarantee this will be an enhance to a lift up, because what's happening on AJC Radio right now is lifting us all up, because guess what? We are in search for justice, and I tell you, this is the night of avenging advocacy groups that are trying to make a difference in our society. Folks, right now on the East Coast, we told you earlier, the sun is already set, and it is about 9:15. I'm sure the kids are getting tucked in and told a little story, and mom and dad are cranking up the coffee, putting a little cream and sugar in that to give you a little lift. And I'll go with Lisa's advice. Red Bull does it probably a little bit better.
Get your wings.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, come on back with us. We are bringing a special gentleman by the name of Ramon Hamilton. And I'm telling you what, Sam, Cliff, Lisa, this man has something to say, and we're going to give him a chance to say it. Folks, this is AJC Radio. I'm Lamont Banks with Sam Thurman, Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart. We're going to be right back. Don't go nowhere. Do you have a big brother? Well, I have a big brother, and I'm pretty sure that you and I experience some of the same things with a big brother. Big brothers will always be big brothers, right? I'm sure you'll agree. Well, my brother gets up in the morning. He takes a shower, heads to work, and at some point during the day, he's going to exercise and get that workout, as we all do. And of course, depending on what's going on, he's going to sit down for two or three meals during the course of his day. And also, depending on what else is going on, he'll probably get caught up on current events and maybe take a few moments to turn a page in a book. How about your big brother? Some of the same stuff, right? Oh, did I mention that my big brother does all of that stuff, but he actually has to have permission a lot of times before he can do it? You see, my big brother was wrongfully convicted of a crime that he did not commit. That's right. That may sound shocking, huh? He's in prison. Wrongful convictions impact families in ways you cannot begin to imagine. But I've decided that I'm going to do something about it. And I extend an invitation to you to come on board and join me in this fight. You see, I'm helping to be a voice for my big brother and others who have been wrongfully convicted. We'd like you to take a few moments today and call a Just Cause, where we fight for justice. You can call us toll-free at 1-855-529-4252. That's 1-855-529-4252. Join with us as we fight for justice and for all big brothers across the land.
The United States of America incarcerates more people than any other country in the world. In fact, the U.S. hosts more prison inmates than all other developed nations combined. As of 2010, the world population was over 6.8 billion people, with an estimated 9.8 million in jail. This figure, compiled by the International Center for Prison Studies, refers both to individuals held in jail awaiting trial and inmates serving time after sentencing. So there are 9.8 million human beings on planet Earth living inside of cages that we know of. In 2010, the U.S. was home to about 309 million people, 4.5% of the world's total population, but housed 23% of the world's prisoners. So take a moment to think about what this means. It means we imprison more people than enormous autocratic countries like China. We imprison more people than Russia. Compared to the size of our population, our rate of imprisonment dwarfs our closest allies, like the United Kingdom, France, and Canada. As of 2010, there were over 1.6 million post-trial inmates serving sentences in America's state and federal facilities. This number does not include those being detained pre-trial or those on probation. The most unique feature of incarceration in America is the large and active role of our federal government. In most countries, crime is reacted to at the local or regional level, whereas the American government finances and legislates a significant portion of law enforcement at the national level. State governments still do their fair share of incarceration, though. California and Texas incarcerate more than other states, with over 171,000 inmates each. Florida is a close third with over 103,000 prisoners. But no single state locks up more people than the federal government, with over 208,000 inmates. Perhaps the nickname Land of the Free, Home of the Brave, should be updated. Though I suppose you need to be brave to endure the highest likelihood of incarceration the world has ever known. Prisons are not what we think about when we think of America, and they shouldn't have to be. A free nation shouldn't imprison so many people, and a fiscally responsible nation can't afford to. With close to $40 billion a year in state correctional spending, the financial costs are obvious and staggering alone, but the human costs are often underappreciated. 1.6 million fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters of American families are incarcerated. It's time for people to realize that the criminal justice system in America is desperately in need of reform.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is AJC Radio, and you're wondering what that noise is. What are we hearing? That's a notes and music of clear and present danger. This country now sits in clear and present danger right now. And tonight we are honoring and bringing light to advocacy heroes that are trying to make a difference. And Sam, Cliff, Lisa, this night is getting more and more intriguing with those that are fighting the fight of against injustice and fighting for justice. And we are very pleased tonight, ladies and gentlemen of America, as you have tuned in on the East Coast, the West Coast, or the Midwest, wherever you may be tonight. Folks are out here trying to make a difference, and they're doing it quickly. And with that, we come in with an extraordinary young man, who we have had the privilege of talking to this week, and I'm telling you, it's been one of those weeks that just kind of this young man is doing some great stuff. And I'm not going to open the Christmas Eve, the package on Christmas Eve and take a peek. I'm not going to let you either do it either, folks. We're going to let Ramon Hamilton come on board with us tonight. And Ramon, we want to thank you for joining us. How are you tonight?
I'm good. And thank you for having this this platform and for having me on. Very much appreciated.
And Ramon, that type of chipper or enthusiasm I hear in your voice, we know it's what you, because of what you do, but I'm sure the sunshine out there in California is not hurting the enthusiasm either, is it?
No, not in the least.
For bringing some of your enthusiasm to us. Ramon, I'll tell you, I had an opportunity to review the video that you and I had talked about. And if, ladies and gentlemen out there of America, if you want to be intrigued and moved and thought-provoked, if that's a word, or something that will cause a thought-provoking action, Mr. Hamilton is doing some great things. And, Ron, I was moved to emotion watching that. And I'm going to let you go ahead and get into that here in a moment. We see here that Ramon Hamilton, for our listeners, is an award-winning writer, director, filmmaker, who takes a very serious approach to media as he seeks to combine entertainment and storytelling to create change. And I've never seen nothing like that. Ramon, are you familiar with the series that used to be on HBO called Oz?
I am. I was a little bit on the younger side when it did come out, so I caught some reruns in the past. But I am very familiar. I'm also familiar with the style, the tone, and the rawness and the grittiness of that show. Absolutely.
And I tell you what, you've made me feel a little bit old, and I don't know how I don't know how much older I am than you, but. Ramon, we're going to dig into this. Folks, if you happen to be having dessert tonight and sitting down by the, well, no fires because we're at spring now, but maybe in front of the fan down in the down where it's really hot and humid, get ready to get a little bit hotter with this story coming up. Ramon, I give you the floor tonight to introduce who you are, man. Let's get into this right now. Go ahead.
It's pretty straightforward. What you just mentioned is pretty much who I am. I'm a filmmaker. I've been using film to humanize those that are unfortunately not being humanized, and to shedding light on social issues, using my skills and talents to create change, to advocate and to give voice to those whose voices have been silenced. That's really me at my core. It wasn't always this way. When I first moved out to California, this was about 11 years ago, I was just pretty much focused on the entertainment side of things. But to make a long story short, the process of creating a film, especially, it requires a lot of people. It requires a lot of resources. It requires a lot of time. It's not as simple as, okay, I'm going to sit in my backyard and do a painting today. It requires a lot of money, so it's one of the most expensive and one of the most, arts that uses one of the most resources. And I came to learn very quickly, that at the end of the day, if I'm going to, invest, let's say a year of my time in getting something off the ground, writing it, shooting it, editing, music and sound, and then getting it out there, then it's got to go beyond just entertainment, because that's a year of my life, So, I've always been someone who's been interested in our society and doing what I can to make this world a better place than how I found it. I'm engaged in my local community and I serve on the Civic Association here. I've always just been very active in terms of just, societal issues and things like that. So, I was like, why can't I marry the two, essentially, and take my passions for both societal change and my love for filmmaking and storytelling and just merge them. So that's essentially what happened. And, we started that back in 2011. We had a feature-length film called Smuggled that really looked at immigration from a totally different lens, that really just looked at a mom and her son. And you just really got to just spend time with these two people. And they were nothing more than just a mother and son. And it became a story about family, not necessarily about immigration. So that's when and that film did very well. We were at 15 festivals worldwide. We ended up winning a third of those festivals. We had a great academic run. We self-distributed the film and actually made profit, which is, really hard to do as an independent filmmaker. It did so well because we focused on, humanizing. Not necessarily you know, putting the issue aside, but let's just look at the people behind the so-called label of an issue. And so now, you know, we're dealing with, you know, at least in my opinion, one of the biggest things that's plaguing our country, which is mass incarceration, also the use of torture within our prisons and how widespread it is. And it's the whole underworld that, you know, that your average American has no clue about.
No, absolutely. And Ron, I tell you, I mean, Ramon, excuse me. I tell you, it's one of those things that a lot of folks think you're dealing with issues that a lot of people don't want to touch. And I think that's why it's having such an impact as it is having, I believe, because of the issues that you're tackling. And these are major issues that face our country. And these are things that a lot of folks want to turn a blind eye to. And I tell you, man, as I turned on that and watched that, as we had talked earlier later last week, I was blown away because it is that real. And I share with you that I was wrongfully convicted. We had an opportunity to share about the IRP6. And I want to ask your thoughts as a director, and how impactful, as we talked very briefly, but got into the meat of the IRP6 story, what kind of impact did that have on you?
I mean, honestly, my mind was kind of blown. You know, the levels of complexity and the levels of injustice are just you know, really through the roof. So, I mean, it's extremely impactful and extremely, you know, saddening, to be honest. I mean, you know, I've actually, you know, have been, in fact, you know, we're working on episode 2 right now for the show. And one of the things that we're exploring is this, you know, a character who is wrongfully convicted and, you know, what does that entail? And, you know, part of doing that, you know, obviously, you know, you said the show is real and, you know, it is real, you know, it's, in my opinion, it's more real than what you can do with a documentary. You know, I mean, you can't just get cameras and go up into a prison and start rolling cameras, you know, that's not going to happen, obviously, especially not like an isolation unit, you know? So, you know, so we research and we work, you know, very closely with those that have experienced these issues. So in the whole, the episode 1, the man that's in the isolation unit, character's name is Marcus Williams. That's a guy, the actor named William Brown. He actually was incarcerated. Spent 8 years in prison. Spent a year and a half in the hole. So he knows what that's like, and he can bring that realism. And so as we explore episode 2, you know, we're doing the same thing and bringing in some different characters and connecting with those who have directly, you know, been impacted. And so, you know, in exploring this, the issues of wrongful conviction, you know, my eyes start to become open to just, you know, how widespread this is. And you know, it's, you know, all of these issues are extremely, you know, damaging, but, you know, wrongful convictions are just, I mean, they're just wrong. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, what you're putting, you know, an individual through who hasn't committed a crime, you know, and the process that I'm learning of, like, what it takes to possibly try to get yourself exonerated is exhausting, you know, and it's, yeah, so, I mean, it's something that absolutely needs to be explored. And, you know, my eyes are definitely, you know, opening up to it. I'm by no means an expert, which is why I collaborate and connect with those that have directly experienced these issues. And so, yeah, I mean, the case of the IRP6 is definitely a story that, you know, that needs to be told. It absolutely needs to be told. And it's, yeah, you know, so, yes, it was very, very, very powerful, shocking, saddening story that, you know, I hope can have, you know, the happiest ending possible, you know, if you want to use that term, you know, so, you know, I mean, obviously time will tell, but it's definitely a story that I think more people need to be aware of. Absolutely.
Ramon, this is Sam again. Welcome to the program. And, I have to echo what Lamont has stated as far as the power of that, that first episode of The Hole. I looked at it this afternoon and I was moved, and so kudos to you and your team because of it gave you that inside view as if you became part of, and I think you said the character's name was Marcus Williams. You became part of his consciousness or his subconscious, if you will. And the way that was depicted in the video was just it left me in awe, and it left me sitting there wondering and thinking and pondering about how folks who are in the prison system, as far as those who are in positions of authority, the psychological games that they play with people and the psychological impact. And you know, often on the program we talk about the extent to which an incarceration affects a person. And it's not just about, you know, that person, but it extends outside of the walls and so forth. But again, just a lot of my hat's off to you. And I would encourage anyone, everyone, to go out there and take a look at the whole. And as Lamont has echoed, you know, it from his personal experience, that it really is like that. And it really seems as though it places you right in the middle of it.
Yeah, no, and you know, I'll tell you, you know, we collaborated with our co-producer, a gentleman named Five Mualim Ock, who is based out of New York City, and he you know, he was a key person in really providing that consultation. He spent over 5 years in the box, so he, or the hole, however you want to refer to it. And I thank him for being, so open. I also thank our actor, William Brown, for being so open, because, I mean, these are guys that are having to, revisit the ugliest parts of their lives, in an attempt to, use it as a positive to show people, like, this is what's going on. I mean, this is, Marcus is just one character, at least at the moment. You know, we're going to expand out in episode two, but, he's just one out of, an estimated 80,000 that are in there right now, and, there's that, number of 2.3 million that are incarcerated. And, I've had so many conversations with those that have been locked up, and I can't think of one conversation I had with someone who hadn't been to the box at one point, so it's, I mean, that 80,000 number, is got to be much larger, so it's just, the story that needs to be told is, the prison system, the criminal justice system, it's whacked out. There's a group of people that obviously know that. I think that voice needs to be much louder, and that's what this show is going to do. It's going to, it's just going to really, highlight the realities of what things are. And, I've had some people say it's hard to watch, and I'm like, yeah, it is hard to watch, but you know what? It's hard to live, I mean, there's people that are living this, so we need to see these realities. It's raw, it's in your face, because that's what's going on. And, we have this system that, it's supposed to be a system of rehabilitation, which is completely not, and people are coming out worse than what they came in. People are literally, leaving there scarred mentally, physically, and then we wonder why we have these high rates of recidivism. I mean, it's just an ugly mess, and the part that so drives me is, I come from just middle class Boston. I live in California now, but I come from Massachusetts, specifically from Boston. And I still connect with a lot of my friends, and these are, just your average guys working their 9 to 5, and they don't know this information. I'm sharing this stuff on Facebook and they're shocked, and it just reveals to me that, like, the voices need to be echoed even more, and it just drives me even more to have to create, this series and push it forward, because just people need to be aware, and I think when people are aware, then the light bulb goes off, and that's what this show is meant to do, is to draw you in a non-threatening way. It's I can tell someone, hey, like you mentioned earlier, you like shows like Oz, okay, well, check this out. Well, when you check it out, you're going to also learn the reality of what's going on in our prisons. So think of it as maybe a backdoor approach. The academic term is actually called entertainment education, but it works, we're going to continue to keep doing it, so I'm actually really excited, because right now literally developing the story for episode two, and it's got some really, really good stuff that I think people are going to embrace, and hopefully get more people to get those light bulbs going off and get some engagement.
Absolutely. And as a follow-up question, Ramon, and you stated that some of your friends can't capture and grasp the concept of the fact that this is reality, and so being from Boston, now in California, what was the tipping point for you and your organization? What drives you as far as the passion to tell this story? I mean, do you have any other personal experience, people that you know that may have been subjected to this, or is it just your social consciousness as far as the you know, wanting to bring about change? You know, was there something that specifically happened that gave you this passion to say, hey, this story has to be told?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. The short answer is yes, there was something very specific that happened. But before I address that, you know, I didn't realize that I had experienced this. You know, not personally, but I didn't realize that I was connected to this because it was so normalized. And what I mean by that is I grew up in two parts of Boston, the South End, which you know, back in when I grew up was definitely not the South End now. It was a very low-income community, you know, housing projects, that kind of thing. And then we moved to a place called Dorchester, Massachusetts, which is, again, you know, a lot of areas of low-income, poverty, crime, that kind of thing. And that's, you know, that's what I grew up in. And so, you know, yeah, guys were getting locked up all the time. You know, we had our own family issues, and I saw my brother, you know, enter the system and come in and out, and I saw that, you know, how it played out in our own family, you know. And to be honest, this is actually the first time I'm talking about, you know, my own personal family. But my point is, you know, it never hit me as like, oh, this is crazy, because it was just normal. It was normal. You know what I mean? So it didn't stick out to me. I thought that's just the way it is. You know, you're a 10-year-old kid. I mean, that's what you see, and that's what it is. Now, flash forward to now, or at least more modern times. The Pelican Bay hunger strikes in 2013. I mean, that was really the tipping point. You know, at that point in time, I was teaching a class in East LA, so I had like a 45-minute commute. So I'd always listen to NPR. And, you know, I caught that story at the very beginning, you know, just a few guys. Then it grew into, you know, that were, you know, literally, you know, starving themselves. Then it grew into, you know, more and more numbers and, you know, thousands. And next thing you know, people are in solidarity across the nation. And, you know, and I started to just, you know, really, you know, learn more about what was going on and, you know, seeing they weren't trying to, you know, they weren't striking to end their solitary confinement. You know, they were striking to improve the conditions. And then when you start to learn about the conditions, you're like, really? Like, you know, it's crazy. And then, you know, we started hearing about the force feedings. And then it just, you know, as we went down that proverbial rabbit hole, I mean, it just opened up this whole, you know, just mess of what our prisons and criminal justice, you know. I mean, originally we were going to do this as just a feature-length film on a guy who's in isolation, but when we started to really look at the story, when I say we, I mean my wife and I, we're both producers on this, on the project, and we worked together for quite some time. But, you know, we were going to just do this feature-length film, you know, 80, 90-minute thing, but when we started looking at, you know, all this information and all these injustices and all different departments, it was like, there's no way a film can do this any justice, and that's when we realized it had to be a show. It has to evolve over time. It has to have a lot of different components, a lot of different characters, and a lot of different stories and things that we follow and learn about. So, I mean, you know, the hunger strikes were definitely the tipping point. And then as I kind of got back in, you know, or not got back, but as I kind of got into, you know, the research and whatnot, you know, it was a light bulb kind of went off in my head and like, yeah, you know, yeah, I did, you know, guys that I know did get locked up all the time. And, you know, neighbors, you know, my own brother, you know, so, you know, to be honest, I got locked up a couple times. So it was like, but again, it was normal. You know what I mean? It was normal. So it didn't stick out. But then I live in a very rural part of Southern California now, and that's not the norm. And now, as an adult, I can recognize that's not the norm. But you know, if I were still growing up there with my own two kids, they'd be just like me and think, "Oh, that's just what it is." And that's scary. That is scary. You know, when something becomes normalized like that, you can have a generation of adults, you know, who think that's just the way things are, and that is extremely scary to me.
Right. And Ramon, this is Cliff. What I look at is, you know, you talk about, you know, I've watched The Hole that you produced, and it is very moving and a very intriguing concept to basically get that type of realism from, you know, just not being there in the prison doing the filming. But when you look at it and you say, okay, individuals who are in prison for white collar crime, and then again, those who are there, you know, wrongfully incarcerated are being subjected to these same type of situations. You take someone like in the IRP 6 case, it's I mean, everybody who's looked at their case says, you know, there's no crime here. These men are in prison for absolutely no reason. And then you say, okay, to put someone like that into solitary confinement in these same type of conditions, what does that do to a person? And you look at it and you say, okay, the guards have taken it upon themselves and so many of these prison complexes to become the punisher of inmates. It doesn't matter if they have actually committed a crime. I mean, the fact that a person has lost their freedom, that they've been taken away from their family, that they're subjected to the type of conditions that you mentioned, is the punishment that, you know, they're not a part of society. But then you put them in solitary confinement, and it totally is a whole nother world for even a truly convicted criminal that actually committed the crime. Then you have a person who says, I did not commit a crime, and they didn't. And then you put them in the same type of conditions. That is what I think so many people in the, you know, just the regular public sphere do not understand, is that this, the solitary confinement issue is not just one in maximum prisons. It is even in camps. If they say, you know, that you did something wrong, they will put you in solitary confinement in that area too.
No, absolutely. And you know, a couple of things to touch on there. I mean, and you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, the thing that I don't think people understand is, you know, the punishment when there is a crime. Let's just assume that there is an actual crime. The punishment is being sent to prison. That is your punishment. You are away from society. Now, while you're in that, you know, prison, you know, it should be that there, you know, everyone is working together so that we can rehabilitate and then re-enter society in a very positive manner. Obviously, that's not happening. Now, when you take the case, you know, of any wrongfully convicted individual who, as you say, you know, has not done a crime, and we, you know, we put them into this place which we already know is not meant to rehabilitate, and then we put them into isolation, which, you know, the UN has straight up said over and over and over that anything more than 15 days in isolation, they consider it torture, plain and simple. Right. I have yet to meet a person who has been in isolation that has only spent 15 days or less. It hasn't happened. You know, so the point is, we are not only putting, you know, yes, innocent people into prison, which is a non-rehabilitative environment, but then we're going beyond that and we're torturing them while they're in prison. Like, people need to understand that, you know? Solitary isn't like just a bad, it's torture. It is torture. You know what I mean? And that, you know, and so, you know, for me to know all this information and to be committed to using film, you know, for social change, I mean, it'd be an injustice for me not to make this project, you know? And so, you know, I mean, yeah, so well, it's disturbing, you know?
Well, Ramon, I'll tell you what, when you have a all-star lineup of heroes, as we have had on this show tonight, man, there's so much information. We're going to invite you back to come back and join us. You are one of three heroes we have talked to tonight. And I wanted to just make a point that, Ramon, in regards to, it says here that you also teach filmmaking to pediatric cancer patients through Think 10 Media, Group Spotlight on Hope Film, Camp Program, and you're teaching a lot of things. Ramon, if I had a hat, and I don't have one in this studio on tonight, I promise you, I tip it to you. You're doing a great thing out there, and I am looking forward to talking more with you. And I want to just say to our listeners out there in America tonight, this is Ramon Hamilton, a man that is not talking the talk, but he's walking the walk. And Ramon, tell these folks how they can get a hold of you.
Absolutely, yeah. The best way to get a hold of me and to actually watch the pilot episode is to go to TheWholeSeries.com, and that's spelled W-H-O-L-E. TheWholeSeries.com, W-H-O-L-E. So they go there. All the contact information is there. There's resources. You can watch the pilot episode. There's behind the scenes. I mean, a whole plethora of information. So that's the best way to go. Check out what we're doing, and you know, contact us. You know, we're open. We want to hear from people.
Well, Ramon, I told the folks tonight, and we're going to let you go on that note. Ramon, you are a pleasure to talk to, and I'm telling you, we're going to get to know each other a lot better. We're going to be posting this stuff out on Twitter, Facebook, and every position of social media, that Ramon Hamilton is making a difference, and these are folks that we need to make a difference. And, Ramon, you've been a pleasure tonight. We thank you so much for joining us. Have a good evening down there in the sunny California area. and we'll be in touch with you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Ladies and gentlemen, Lisa made the statement earlier. You heard the popping of a can. That can was opening a Red Bull, but I'm going to go a little further. You may want to grab a cup of coffee, cappuccino, hot chocolate with some marshmallows was my favorite coming up. Whatever it takes to relax you tonight, a warm glass of milk and maybe some orange juice, perhaps some peanut butter or chocolate chip cookies, whatever your desire is. Ladies and gentlemen, we're just settling in, and we say that to make ourselves at home. And folks connect being at home with having a little something to drink, a little something to eat. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been in your home this evening around the dinner table, the dessert bar, the refrigerator, or the freezer, but we've enjoyed having you tonight. We're going to come right back. Ladies and gentlemen, we have talked to Avengers of Justice and those that are fighting injustice and those of the unseen heroes of advocacy. It's been a pleasure tonight. Stay where you're at so we can close you and tuck you in and get you ready for bed. This is AJC Radio. We're coming right back at you. Go.
Do you know anyone who's been sent to prison who is innocent? The United States is experiencing record numbers of exonerations in cases where people were wrongly convicted of crimes that they did not commit. If you believe that no one should be sent to prison for crimes they didn't commit, there is something that you can do today by remembering A Just Cause with a monthly, annual, or one-time donation. You can help in the fight against wrongful convictions. Call A Just Cause toll-free at 1-855-529-4252. Again, 1-855-529-4252. Or visit www.a-justcause.com and click the donate button. Wrongful convictions are wrong. Let's be the voice of those who can't speak from behind the wall. A Just Cause is a 501c3.
History is important because it shows where you're coming from and where you're going. Type 2 diabetes is something that runs in my family, which means I'm at risk. In fact, 1 in 3 American adults are at risk for developing type 2 diabetes. And knowing this, if I do nothing, that family history becomes my family's future. And my family is too important to me for that. Take the risk factor assessment today at AskScreenKnow.com.
My name is Brian Banks. In 2002, I was wrongfully convicted of a crime I did not commit. I know you hear that a lot, but in my case, it's true.
The California Innocence Project is a nonprofit clinic at California Western School of Law devoted to investigating and litigating cases where innocent people may have been wrongfully convicted. My name is Justin Brooks, and I'm director of the California Innocence Project. Since 1999, we've investigated thousands of cases. Where there's strong evidence of innocence, we go to court and we free our clients. Law students and law professors work together to seek justice in these cases. Over the past 14 years, we've been able to free many innocent clients. So if you or someone you know has been falsely convicted of a crime, or if you'd like to donate to our cause, then please contact the California Innocence Project at californiainnocenceproject.org.
The California Innocence Project had my conviction reversed, gave me my life back, and helped me fulfill my dream of playing in the NFL.
Please support the California Innocence Project and help bring home victims of an imperfect justice system.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you're wondering what that is, We are fighting a war that some folks have called Mission Impossible. But I got news for you tonight. With the heroes that we've talked to tonight and what AJC Radio is doing, I can assure you that the mission is not impossible. And ladies and gentlemen, we came back tonight to tuck you in. Cliff, Lisa, and Sam, what a program tonight of information.
Awesome.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, if we're talking about three people that we have talked to tonight that are making that much of a difference, it tells me that the fight for justice is very, very clear. And it takes just folks that are committed to fighting this fight. And I think that's very, very important. Lisa, what are your thoughts as we close this program tonight? As we've heard what advocacy and the heroes of advocacy people are doing, what does that do for you as you sit here and begin to observe this tonight?
Well, I'll tell you, it makes you feel good that there are people out there that are really trying to do something good. We hear so much about the bad that's going on, the senseless killings, the different things that are happening with the police and different things that are going on all across the country. It's nice to hear that there are people out there that are actually fighting for something that's good, doing what we're doing, actually trying to bring light and shine a light on what's good and do something good and just get out there and make a difference, because not everybody wants to make a difference.
Oh, absolutely.
So when you find somebody who's willing to try to make a difference, then we want to support them in any way we can.
And I think it's important. Sam, your closing thoughts on that?
Yeah, as far as, Teresa Hodge, Howard Franklin, and Ramon Hamilton, as Lisa was just saying, these are folks who are in the thick of it. And I think each one of them alluded to a comment relative to the fact that you have people out there that are, and we talk about it from time to time, they're complacent because nothing has happened to them. It's not on their doorstep. It hasn't happened to anyone that any of their loved ones. But when something does happen, and in each one of these cases, each one of them was involved and are still involved, it really is something that the nation needs to grab a hold of and ensure that our constitutional rights are secured and that we don't have the epidemic continuing that's running rampant in our land.
Cliff, your closing thoughts on this show tonight.
Yeah, I think it's very crucial with what these three individuals are doing as advocacy groups. I mean, they are exposing the hard issues especially Ramon Hamilton, to go and say, hey, I'm presenting to America what really goes on behind the wall. Because we get so many stories in the media, every time you see something in the media, like, oh yeah, we went in, but that's just like when they do an inspection, they let you know when they're coming. This is somebody who has gone, got experience from people who were there, and is now presenting it in a in a video fashion to say, hey, this is what's up. And for the other two individuals as well, Teresa Hodge and Howard Franklin, I mean, they're out there saying, hey, this is what's going on. And that's what it takes, is to really get out there. And to be an advocate, you have to deal with the hard issues. You have to deal with what's really going on. We see so many so-called civil rights leaders that they aren't doing anything. They want to get in front of and get their 15 minutes of fame. But the people who are really making a difference, they're the ones in the ditches that a camera, might not be on them. But they're making serious advances, and they're really the ones who are making change as far as advocacy goes.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we couldn't have said it any better. The definition of advocacy is a political process by an individual or group which aims to influence decisions within political, economic, and social systems and institutions. Advocacy can include many activities that a person or organization undertakes, including media campaigns, public speaking, commissioning and publishing, research or conducting exit poll, or the filing of information. All is a form of advocacy where direct approach is made to legislators on an issue which plays a significant role in modern politics. Research has started to address how advocacy groups in the United States and Canada are using social media to facilitate civic engagement and collection action. Ladies and gentlemen, most folks have Twitter handles, and they'll say, like me on Facebook, and you always can follow on Twitter. All three guests tonight that were on this program were reached out through social media. That should give you an indication of the importance of social media in this day and age, that a message of justice and the fight against injustice can go out. Ladies and gentlemen, as you get ready to tuck in tonight and turn the lights off in the house, maybe leave the night light or the front porch on, think about what lies ahead for this nation. We are excited. In about a few weeks from now, I believe next week, we will be highlighting Congresswoman Sheila Jackson on our new campaign entitled Spotlight on Capitol Hill. And that's Congressman Jackson Lee. And I'll tell you, that's one fascinating woman we're going to talk about and shine the light on her legislation, her passions, and what she intends to do to in this country. You do not want to miss that. Cliff, let's get ready to close out.
Absolutely. We want to say thank you to all of our guests, to Ms. Teresa Hodge, Mr. Howard Franklin, and Mr. Ramon Hamilton. We appreciate you guys taking part of your evening to spend with us to, you know, bring us informative information. It really was, I really was impacted, and we appreciate all three of you for doing that for us. To our production crew, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson, helping out ill-skilled girl in the control room to make sure you hear what it is that we have to say. Also, to our production support team, we want to say thank you to them for the update, up-to-date, and accurate information that they bring to make sure that we can pass that on to you. To everybody in the chat room, we appreciate your questions, your comments. Keep it going. You guys were burning it up in there tonight. A great conversation. We really appreciate that. Also, to the truth. We know you're out there. We appreciate you.
I want to say thank you to our people behind the scenes. We have Olivia. We have Miss Barbara. We have Lynette that are working back behind the scenes for us, giving us great information, helping us get this show rolling smoothly. We appreciate everything you do.
Okay, folks. Ladies and gentlemen, this is AJC Radio searching to bring the message. And what we are doing is bringing the message of justice around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, this is about you. This is about your children and their children. And, folks, it gets better every time on AJC Radio. And I'm glad that you've joined your evening with us as you get ready to retire and get a good night's sleep under the stars. Ladies and gentlemen, enjoy yourself. Join us next week as we continue the fight against injustice.
Country. Maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America